My name is Samantha, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to recovery and or understanding. Elaine will read the preamble.
Good evening. My name is Elaine, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Lauren will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Lauren, and I'm an alcoholic. The steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
David will read the traditions.
Sorry. Hi, I'm David. I'm an alcoholic. The traditions, the long form. Okay, I was going to say. All right. Number one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Number two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself as a group conscience, in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Number three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Number four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Number five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Deborah Connie.
My name is Deborah Connie. My nickname is DC, and I'm an alcoholic. I have a home group. The Atlantic group is my home group. I'm on step 9 and 10, about to start step 11, and April 7th, 2008 is my sobriety date. Okay, so my sponsor's name is Jaina, and I owe a very big debt to Jaina, who has helped me work the steps. I don't have much except my experience with a progressive illness and a message of love and hope and a history of being taken care of by a power that I don't understand. And I would like to share that with you today. So, the first story I would like to share is DC and the tequila shots at 10 in the morning taken before a fabulous bike ride with her former lover through the countryside outside of a small town in rural China while her boyfriend is still in America thinking that she is doing God knows what. Okay. So the shots that we took before the bike ride were for the exhaustion from the partying for the night before. They were also from the plane ride, or the shots were from the need to be peppy and upbeat during the next adventure, or the shots were from the fear that her former lover was really in love and crushing on another girl and the resentment against that girl, or fear, 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 fear of maybe why she was actually there, that she had no clue why she was really there, or the shots were to hide the shame of the unmanageability of why she was there. Basically, this microphone's bothering me. I want it to be lower. I want control over the microphone. That would be awesome. Anyway, basically, when it comes down to that bike ride, I wanted it to be a bike ride in the countryside in China. I just wanted it to be that. And it wasn't. It wasn't. But I could use alcohol to be normal. I could use alcohol to make it seem like it was just a bike ride through a countryside with a friend, and I can deny everything else about what might have actually been in reality. Through working the steps, I realized I was cheating on a man who loved me. And I was scared. After graduating college, I was scared. I didn't want to go on with my life. So I traveled to China, and I used any excuse to get to China. And I was drinking the whole time, okay? So you see, a normal person might have felt that fear. I don't know what they would have done, okay? But I felt that fear, and I drank, and I disconnected from that fear because the alcohol numbed me enough that I could... I could keep going to the next action. I could go to China. I could take that bike ride. Another episode I will share with you is DC and eating clean, the raw diet of fruits, vegetables, raw wine, and raw sake. That was a good one. Alcohol made me really sick. I started drinking when I was 14 years old, and I don't know, my body, like, I get really sick all the time from drinking, and I was, like, determined, all right, I'm not going to drink anymore, so I'm going to use a clean diet, and I'm going to, like, get really, you know, but I couldn't put down drinking because in the literature that I was reading, it said, well, raw sake and biodynamic wine is okay. And I was like, you know, okay. And the final story I will relate before I get into the solution is that DC and the red wine alone in the motel room in Milan, where I went to Italy, and I told my parents that I was going to shoot a screen test for a famous director, and I told my friend who I was going with they were going to interview an artist at a gallery, and I wanted company, when in reality I was going there because he wanted to go there, and it seemed like a good idea because it was the next logical action, and I told my friend I was sick and I needed to go home, and he said like, I'll help you, and I said, it said, whatever it said, I disconnected from that help. I could not say, I need help. It took me until I came into the rooms a year ago to say, I surrender, I need help. You know, I need help. I'm running around like a crazy person and I'm insane. And, you know, step one, my life is unmanageable. I could not see that because I had my drink. I had the drink. I mean, I don't know if it was because, I can't say I'm going to figure that out right now, but I will say that I did not see that how unmanageable my life was until I started working the steps. Okay. So basically, in Italy, that was the bottom for me because I ran out of pharmaceuticals then, and I was drinking and I was taking those recreationally, and I was drinking red wine to black out because the pain from detoxing all those pharmaceuticals was so intense, and so I'm very lucky to be alive. I was drinking for that blackout. I was drinking for that. I needed that end, you know? So after that, I realized I could not, I stayed away from alcohol. Stayed away for a year, and if you asked me a few months ago, I would have said I was dry before I came into the rooms, but that wasn't true. The one time I was social for that year before I came into the rooms, I drank. That one time I was social for a whole year. I drank because I had no idea of how to live in society without alcohol. To be a human being without alcohol. Oh my gosh. Anyway, the lucky thing is that I found it to the rooms, and I'd like to tell you the story of how I met my sponsor, which is basically I have this God box, and when I'm anything that I'm worried, fearful, angry, nervous about, anything that's going to kill me, those feelings, they will kill me if I let them. So I turn it over to God in a box. I write it on a piece of paper and I put it in a box. And I put like recovery outside of New York City in a box. And then I went to a meeting, and then a friend introduced me to this guy who had a bed in a house with a bunch of sober people out in Montauk just that night. And I was like, oh my God, okay. And so I started going to meetings out in Montauk, and then I met this wonderful woman named Vicky Carillo, and she was just like, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. And I felt that. I really believed her. It was like she took me to a meeting, then she took me to the diner, and then she's like, took me to a meeting. It was just like so simple, just so simple, and I could stop figuring it out. I could just stop figuring it out. It was just so simple. You know, it's like just like I could breathe. I really hadn't felt like I could breathe for so long. And then she said, when you get to New York City, you're gonna call Peggy, and she's gonna hook you up. And so I called Peggy. I had no clue. My mind's like, nah, nah, nah. I'm like, the actions I take are so simple. I call Peggy. Peggy's like, meet me at the meeting, and I meet her in the front row, and I'm sucking on a lollipop in the front row, and I hear my sponsor speak, and I've been thinking about that I need a sponsor that will take me through a sponsor that's going to take me through the big book before this, because I realized that I can't have a relation. When I came in, I was like a raw nerve. I could not relate. I had not yet had a relationship, an honest an honest, this is really hard for me to admit, but you know, I think a lot of us can relate to that. I haven't really had an honest relationship, a real relationship. I didn't know how to relate to anybody. So I couldn't like just, I need my notes because I'm so, you know. Anyway, Jaina was speaking and she was talking about the Big Book, and she was talking about her service commitment at the Big Book meeting that they have on Wednesday nights. And her story about being taken care of and about working the steps, and I wanted that, and I wanted someone that would take me through the steps. And I saw this peace, and I wanted that peace. And and then I asked her to be my sponsor, and the rest is history. And I've been able to be sober for a year and taken care of this whole time throughout my entire life, but now I get to be grateful and do it as a witness. And I just would like to say that, you know, what's great is I don't have to figure things out today. And if you're new or if you're old, the only words I can say are is that we just have today and you just have to stay sober today and and you're okay. And I'm very grateful for my life and for my sobriety, and I hope you all have a very good evening.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Matt.
Hello, everyone. I'm Matt Lemon, and I'm an alcoholic. And because of this fellowship and God and strong sponsorship, I haven't felt it necessary to take a drink since September 19th of 2004, and for that, I am very grateful. And before I get started, I just want to thank Jero for asking me to speak. Not sure where he's sitting, but thank you very much. And thanks to the founders of this group, which saved my life, and I'm eternally grateful. I've had a service commitment. I've been a member of this group since I decided to, you know, get right with my life and try really give sobriety a try. And I love doing service here. And thank you to everyone who does service here. And with that, I will tell you, as the book says, I'll disclose in a general way what my story was, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born to two hippie parents, late 60s, out in Long Island, they were definitely alcoholics, and they did a lot of other things too, and life was kind of weird around my house. My mother, we had this like glass screen door, and my mom painted on it. They were artists, my parents, you know, Central Park, the whole thing. And my mom painted "Peace to all who enter here." You know, when you're living in like a middle class Catholic Jewish neighborhood, you know, in Long Island, that doesn't really go over too well, you know. So right away, you know, I totally felt different, you know. I was in my head. I was the shortest kid. I was the worst looking kid. I was the worst athlete. I couldn't make friends. And I was very, very, very fearful. And I always say, you know, thank God I found alcohol when I did, about 11 years old, because if I didn't, I probably would have killed myself. And alcohol became my solution to life, you know. Right away, I could talk to girls. I was a good athlete. I was pretty good looking. And I could play sports, you know. All of a sudden, I was like 6 feet tall, you know, and I wasn't the shortest kid anymore. And it was great, and it was really great. And alcohol, like, took me to another place. My first time getting drunk was at a block party. I was invited by some older kids who apparently thought I could drink, and, you know, they wanted me to go with them, or so I thought. And we had a keg, at this block party, and it's the early 80s, and, you know, the heavy metal is the hot music, and it's like Black Sabbath and Ozzy Osbourne, and I'm rocking out, and the music was angry, and I'm getting drunk, and that's all that, you know, I remember. You know, the next thing I know, I'm waking up in my parents' house. I don't know how I got back there, and I don't know what happened, but I was very, very ill. And, you know, my mom thought it was hysterical, and she's taking care of me, and the bottom line is I probably should have never drank again. That's how sick I got. That's how bad of a drinker I was, you know. But sure enough, I was looking to do it again as soon as possible. And that's the disease, you know. All through high school, you know, my drinking intensified. My parents started making money in the 80s, and they went from hippies to yuppies. And, you know, the broken down, rusted out car became a Cadillac and then a Mercedes. And they sent me off to boarding school because they didn't know what to do with me anymore, you know. And I hated it. And I did everything I possibly could to get kicked out. And I did. And then I went to another place and I got kicked out. And my parents, you know, I was back in their house. And I ended up finishing school in a public school. My senior year in a different school, you know, as a guy, you know, that really threw me for a loop. You know, I didn't know anybody, and here I am as a senior, and, you know, that just made my drinking intensify. You know, I just got drunk, and I always found the people wherever I went that drank like I did, because, you know, I didn't want to be like this freak that I thought I was, and this dirt bag, you know, who did other things in addition to alcohol. I mean, alcohol really was what did it for me, but, you know, so I found people to run with, and I always did. And I went off to college, and I pledged a fraternity, and, you know, because that's where the drinking was. And, you know, sure enough, I got like a 1.65 my first semester in school. And, you know, didn't surprise my dad either, but, you know, he did what he had to do to keep me in school. My early thing was I was taken care of by my parents. You know, they wanted to make, like, sweep it under the rug, you know. And but all along, like DC said, I totally identified with that. Like, I was always taken care of, you know, because I went, drinking took me places that I, you know, never thought I would go. I ended up hanging out with people that I never thought I would hang out with and doing things I never thought I would do. And it got really scary. I hit my bottom in my mid-30s, and, you know, I decided for the first time to seek help. I was told I should seek help by my good friends, you know, who had enough with me, you know, the one or two that stayed around after all those years. And, you know, after hurting them for the last time, you know, they said, you know, you need to get help. And I did. I listened to them. But I went to see a psychiatrist because I thought I was crazy. I didn't really acknowledge the fact that the drinking was the problem. Psychiatrist talked to me for 15 minutes. And he's like, you're an alcoholic, you know, and you're in luck because I run a great program, you know, in a hospital, and I'm admitting you tonight. And I said, there's no way that's happening. I was way too vain, you know. I'm like, what am I going to tell my good friends and my parents? You know, of course they knew I had a problem. They probably would have thought it was a great idea, but I didn't go, you know. He said, well, if you're not going to do that, then I'd like you to at least go into drug and alcohol counseling, sort of like an outpatient thing. And that I can handle. You know, I've been in therapy since I was 15 years old, you know. So I went, and the therapist, after, you know, a first or second session, said to me, I can't help you. What you have, the only thing that can help you is Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God he put his ego away, you know, and said that to me. It's a story about that in the back of the book. Same thing happens to somebody in one of the stories in the back of the book. And I'm really grateful. And he told me to find it on my own. I asked him, where should I go? And I ended up going to a meeting out on Long Island. I have an office out there. I didn't want anyone to see me on the east side, you know. And sure enough, you know, I went to meetings, and I stuck around for a little while. I put together like 5 months, you know. But, you know, they said things like get a home group, get a sponsor, get a commitment. And sure enough, I didn't do any of those things. So I'm sure it comes as no surprise to a lot of people in this room. After 6 months, I felt I was going to reward myself with a trip to the Bahamas and for my all that clean time. And I got on that plane and I said, I'm drinking, you know, and that's it. I mean, and I ripped it up that weekend in the Bahamas. And I got off the plane and I decided, I'm not telling anybody. And
I went to, you know, the phone's ringing, it's a couple people from AA, I'm going to meetings, oh yeah, everything's great, you know? And I don't know if anybody here has, like, drank and gone to meetings and lied about it, but it's really not very cool inside, you know? So I decided, you know what, I'm not lying anymore, I'm just drinking. So, so that set off, you know, another summer of debauchery, the summer of 2004, and sure enough, after Labor Day, and another just catastrophic evening, I decided, you know, through the help of another relationship walking out the door, you know, that I should get sober. And I called somebody who happened to be an old member of this group living in Arizona, and he referred me to his sponsor, Rick, who was a member of this group, and I met Rick, and Rick right away, you know, like, he had this, like, he had it, and I saw it, and I knew the game was up. He was like a no-nonsense guy. I was all about nonsense, and I knew that I wasn't getting away. I wasn't getting away with any of it from him. We embarked on the journey of the steps, and my life began to change. And, you know, the steps are amazing. Through the fourth step, I learned to forgive my mother and to learn so that I saw my part in it. And sure enough, because of the steps, I got to make a nine-step amends to my dad before he passed away. And in that nine-step amends, he told me, you know, my sponsor told me, if you know, ask him if there's anything I left out or there's anything I could do to make this amends work, you know. And he told me, stop messing with your mom already. And I get to live that amends every day with her today, you know. She used to call. I used to, like, ignore, you know, on the cell phone, call waiting. And now we speak every day, you know, and I'm there for her. I'm the man that she needs me to be. So if you're new, you know, just stick around. Like, you know, take those directions that I didn't take at first, but now that I've taken, and your life will change too. So everyone, thanks.
And our main speaker tonight is Carol.
Is this okay? Okay. I'm waiting for my roadie to come out here and adjust the microphone. my name's Carol. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I want to thank Heidi for asking me to speak. It's really quite an honor. You know, when she called me, she told me about the dress code. I hope this is okay. Picked it out for you guys. And she said to me, I quote, "We're a large, enthusiastic group." I got sober in York, Pennsylvania, so when I heard that, I'm thinking 40, 50 people a little hopped up on coffee. You know what I mean? This is really beyond what I thought. Which is probably good. If I had known about this, I'd have been a lot more nervous. So, anyway, my quick bio, my sobriety date is July 10th, 1989, and my home group is from a land far, far away known as Netcong, New Jersey. It's the Working with Others group, and we're holding that uni breakfast. I hope you come. It's going to be really great. And I have a sponsor, and I am a sponsor, and I have a service commitment at my home group. Saturday I'll be making name tags. And my official standing with my home group is I'm in charge of the cake on Sunday. That's right. It's a lot of clout. That carries some juice. But, you know, I'm really, you know, service has always been a part of my sobriety. So they say bring a cake, I'll bring a cake. And they say, can you come and speak? And I'll come and speak. So I know my job here is pretty simple. You know, my personal adventure before and after. So let's see, I had a crazy early childhood. My mother, I love her, I adore her, but she didn't make good decisions about men. Not that I can fault her, because the apple doesn't fall that far from the tree, but, you know. So, in essence, so she gets pregnant with May to an alcoholic who lies to her, shocking, and tells her that he's infertile. With clearly a lie, because here I am. So suddenly he's not very appealing. She doesn't want to marry him, but she does marry several men after that. We're like on number four now, and he's a keeper. It's been 25 years. We're holding on to him. We love him. But the point is like, I am bouncing around. You know, there's all these husbands. There's a couple uncles, you know, in between. And you know, I remember we found this book, this like box one time of like things from my childhood. And I'm not kidding, it was like second grade. I had a report card for each different semester from a different school. I mean, I was all over the place. And, you know, to me, actually, I thought it was kind of fun and interesting. You know, and quite frankly, when later on, when my life was chaotic, it didn't seem that odd because I remember that from before. I'm like, I can go through this. But fortunately, my mom met a really great guy, and he adopted me as his own, and we settled down into a really normal life. I grew up in East Berlin, Pennsylvania, which, you know, you need a magnifying glass to find that one on the map, but it's really lovely. And, you know, I was raised as an only child, and we had horses and dogs, and, you know, I just adored this, and I was a good kid. You know, I got good grades. I was on the honor roll. I was a competitive gymnast, a cheerleader, and my boyfriend was the captain of the basketball team and his class president. Stuff to make you gag, really, isn't it? I mean, seriously, a little bit. So, in fact, I got a little choked up there just saying it. Hang on. So, you know, like, so when I went out at night, my parents didn't worry about me. You know what I mean? I don't, you know, I had this freaky gene in the back of me, but nobody knew about it, you know, until later. So, later we found out the hard way. But I remember my first drink. It was cold duck. And I remember it sounded so elegant, you know, and it was pink and bubbly, and it just looked fantastic. It was New Year's Eve, and I had some, my parents had some, we poured some out for the dogs, I kid you not, we all had cold duck. And it didn't taste very good. I'm trying to watch my language. It was bad, and nothing magical happened, and I remember like being early in sobriety and people talking about that first drink and how something magical happened to them. And that wasn't my story. And if that's not your story, hang on, you know. So that was it. First drink, nothing. You know, a couple keg parties, nothing. If my girlfriends and I felt like being particularly naughty, we would hop in my baby blue Pinto and kick an 8-track, stick shift. That's right. We were styling. Little meatloaf playing in the, you know, the 8-track. And... and we would drive down to Maryland and get a 6-pack and a pack of cigarettes. Okay, so 4 girls, 6 beers. Is that alcoholic drinking to you guys? Not to me. You know, so I don't remember fighting over who got the other 2. You know, I just don't remember. So, it's honestly, like, I really, the on-ramp to the alcoholism highway was really long for me. And I remember this distinctly. So I'm in Pennsylvania. I'm living large. You know, everybody's happy. And my parents get this brilliant idea that they want to move to Arizona. And I'm not really digging that, but it's not like I have a whole lot of choice. So we moved to Scottsdale, Arizona. I think it's like the middle of my junior year, late junior year. Not a great time to move. And when I went to school, Coronado High School, in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I pulled in, I thought it was some like crazy joke. Like, I'm like, somehow I'm at the community college, and my parents didn't tell me. You know, it's a huge school, and I can tell immediately that I don't fit in. You know, I'm like Ellie Mae Clampett from Pennsylvania, right? And it's bad. I'm telling you, it's really bad. I dressed weird. And this is a strange school anyway. I mean, honest to goodness, there's so many cliques. There, we had the kickers. Those were the fake cowboys. You know, they had like the tobacco can, the cowboy boots and the hats. You know, there's not a horse or a cow in sight, but there we got them. I'm not kidding. We have the surfers again with the Ocean Pacific and the Vans. It's the desert. There's not a wave anywhere. So we've got them, the jocks, the debutantes, the cheer. I mean, all these different cliques. And I tried. You know, I'm like, you know, I'll try and make my way into somewhere. It's just not happening. And I can identify with Matt because I thought, you know what? When I look back, if I hadn't had alcohol, I don't know what I would have done. Because you know what? When that anxiety got to me, when the pressure got to me, alcohol took the edge off, you know? And it was okay. It didn't make me fit in, but I sure as heck didn't care anymore. You know what I mean? Yeah. I didn't go to graduation. I remember driving by and, like, flipping them off, and I'm chugging beers. Ah! Something crazy. And I'm really lucky I graduated. I remember this, how quickly my life declined, you know, with the alcoholism taking over. I was like college prep, straight A's, all this stuff. You know, I barely get out of high school. Barely. I mean, I've got nearly as many absenteeisms as I do attendance, and I'm always rushing to the mailbox so I can steal that stuff before my parents find out what I'm really doing, this alter life I have. So I finally get out of high school, and the truth is I'm drinking, not every day, and it's not like bad stuff's happening to me when I'm drinking, okay? I'm not really suffering any consequences. And this is the tricky part, because I remember, like, after I graduated from high school and I was a little bit more free, I moved out of my parents' house and I could party the way I wanted to, that I was having a good time. You know, and they talk about that in the big book, you know, about, you know, joy and conviviality and, you know, all that, you know, the gayness. It's so fun, you know, and I remember that. I would be, like, bouncing around these cool clubs outside of Arizona State University, and it was fun. And I chased that carrot all the time. I kept thinking later on when the, you know, stuff was happening, man, I was really having some consequences. I remember thinking, like, I remember when it was good. So clearly I've just got the mixture wrong. You know, okay, so Southern Comfort first, and then beer. Maybe that'll make it right. Or tequila never, you know. I was trying to figure out, like, what I was doing wrong, that I was wrecking my car, you know, that I was throwing up on myself, that I was, you know, all this bad stuff. So, you know, I'm in Arizona, I'm doing this crazy stuff, hang on. And my parents decide, we're going to move back to Pennsylvania, what do you say? Hang on, let me check my calendar. Yeah, I'm free. So, you know, I'm doing nothing, really, you know. So I'm like, okay, and I know now in the back of my mind I'm thinking, you know, geographical cure, right? I'll try this. So, you know, that's it, just kind of like escape. Get away from all those bad influences and all that kind of stuff. So I go to back to Pennsylvania. I enroll in college. I get a really nice job. I'm a waitress at this really high end, well, for York, Pennsylvania, not for you guys here. Never mind. Forget I said it. So, you know, but for me, you know, I'm wearing a little bow tie and I'm flambéing duck and I'm opening wine. It's, you know, I know. So I'm like, okay, this is good. And I enroll. You know, I'm in college, so I'm thinking, okay, we're on the right track. And you know what, like. You know, disease is progressive, man. You know, like 4 years later, I am pouring Long Island iced teas at 7 in the morning at a biker bar, you know, called the Old Wheel. Nice establishment. Not. There's nothing wrong with bikers. Love you. Biker bars, it's fine. I don't mean to disparage anything of that nature. But clearly my career path had taken a turn, you know. So, I mean, that's... You know, stuff's happening to me. I'm having blackouts a lot. I mean, I didn't recognize that was symptomatic of drinking. I really didn't. And, you know, in the morning it would be like, I'd have to play Columbo to figure out, like, what had happened the night before. You know what I mean? Like, let's go through the clues in the front seat of the car, shall we? All right. California coolers. Didn't know I drank those, but apparently I'd like them now. There's a you know, a Burger King wrapper so good I ate at some point during the night. You know, I remember one time I found this man's shoe, like this one flip-flop. I know. Just one. I don't know who. If it's yours, I'm sorry. We'll make amends later. I don't have it anymore. You know, and so I'm like, I'm laughing. I'm like, this shoe. And I mentioned this to one of the girls I work with. She's like, oh, it's nothing. I found my underwear in the glove compartment one morning, you know. And I'm sure she did, you know, because I, you know, so I don't even recognize my life's that kooky yet, because the people I hang with, it's that kooky, and it's still kind of funny, you know. It's, you know. And then it just, you know, it just gets worse, you know. It just gets worse. And, you know, I remember hearing one time about normal people. They set goals for themselves and then alter their behaviors to meet those goals. And alcoholics alter their goals to meet their behaviors. Ah, yes, I see some nodding heads. Anyone identifying with that special comment? And that was me. You know, I just disintegrated into something I didn't even recognize anymore. You know, it just took me down, and all I could think about was just, where am I going to get more? Where am I going to get more? How long is what I can get going to last me? And when am I going to, you know, can I get the next? You know, I remember this, you know, reading about being irritable, restless, and discontent. And I didn't recognize that's what it was, because I hadn't gotten sober yet, you know. And but I remember this feeling that would come over me when I didn't even have to have the alcohol. I had to just watch my bartender pour it for me. You know, I'd be all bound up and wound up and, you know, tweaked out. And I would pull into my favorite saloon, Petzl-Tucky. You know, cheap drinks anyway. At least it had some upside. And I'd sit down and I'd watch smoke pour my shot of Southern Comfort and get me my draft. And I would feel a sense of calm. And I hadn't even drank it yet. You know, there's something really wrong with me. I had had a lot of issues around reasons to quit drinking. I mean, a ton of them, and none of them mattered. And I think my moment of clarity is so strange because it was so minimalist, but yet it meant a lot to me. My father's birthday is July 8th, and I was living with my parents because that's what we wind up doing a lot of times. And you know what? I couldn't even bring myself to get that man a card. You know, I'm so self-centered. I'm so, you know, dehumanized that I don't even care enough about this man that has raised me as his own enough to get him a birthday card. And for some strange reason, the next morning, I saw it on his face, you know, and it, all of a sudden, I could just see it. You know, my moment of clarity was like God flipping on a light switch and saying, you know, take a look around, kid. Look at what you've become. And it was enough to motivate me to get some help. And the next day I was, you know, I woke to my first day of sobriety in the same hospital I was born at. How fitting is that, huh? And that was July 10th, and I spent a day or so there in detox. And then they shipped me off to rehab, and I loved it. I'd still be living there if they hadn't kicked me out after 28 days. I'm telling you, it was summer camp for drunks. I mean it. It was... It had a pool, tennis courts, seriously, on the hill, looking over the river. We ate steak and shrimp, and I'm telling you, this place was rocking. Here's the kicker, though. You know, I spent a lot of money to find out Alcoholics Anonymous is free, you know, because that's pretty much it. You know, they kind of clean you up, and, you know, I learned a little bit about the disease of alcoholism, which was good because I didn't really understand that, you know, it's progressive. Guess what? You're here. You're not getting back here. It's just going to go back air. And then they taught me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember, how are we doing? Okay, good. I remember, like, when I left, they had this, like, aftercare program. And they're this is what you need to do. You need to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm like, okay, that sounds reasonable. Not like I'm doing a lot else stuff. Get a sponsor. Get a home group. All sounds reasonable. Stay away from boys. I didn't like that part very much, but that's a whole other story. But so the sponsor thing, you know, I think about this. You know, when I was out there, man, I would drink and just snort, smoke anything you handed to me. You know, it could be like, Carol, try this. It's, you know, rocket fuel and, you know, coconut rum. Okay. You know, I did anything, I'd try it. But now I'm thinking about a sponsor. You know, I used to put my life in the hands of strangers all the time. And now looking for a sponsor is like the most, I'm scared to death. Like if I get the wrong one, that's it, I'm done. You know? And so I'm really putting a lot of thought and effort into this. And I would go to meetings and I'd hear some woman speak and I'd be like, that's really cool. Well, I like that. Ooh, I don't like her shoes. Okay, what's over there? I mean, just dumb stuff. And I remember hearing somebody say, you know, find somebody that has what you want. That sounds great, except I'm an idiot, you know, at this point. And so, seriously, I'm like, what, I don't know, you know, 3 months sober maybe, so I'm an idiot. And so I'm thinking, okay, what I want, okay, I want a sports car and a good-looking boyfriend. She has those. That's my sponsor. So off I go. And so I got Laura, and she was a great sponsor. I mean, you know what, half the time, you know, God takes care of fools and babies, and I'm a little bit of both at this point. So, you know, he put me in contact with this girl, and she was fabulous. You know, I picked her for the wrong reasons, but it was exactly what I needed. I got her and her whole posse, and I was like their little, like, science project. I'm telling you, they bossed me around, told me what to do, all this stuff, and I don't know, it just never occurred to me to say no, you know? They were sober longer than me, so all right. So it's early sobriety, and I'm having a blast. I really am. I got to tell you, my life got really, you know, really good, really fast, you know, and that, quite frankly, was a little bit dangerous because, you know, I'm only working on something if I'm beaten into submission, you know what I mean? And so I'm just like bouncing around in meetings, and I'm going to dances and bowling and all this fun stuff. And one of Laura's posse approached me one time in a meeting, and he's like, "Hey, Carol, how's it going?" I'm like, "It's great." I'm like, there's a dance on Saturday, and then of course we're going bowling, and I'm going on meetings. Everything's great. And he goes, yeah, that's cool. He goes, you can sit in a garage for a month. That's not going to make you a car. And then he walks away. And I'm like, what kind of messed up AA riddle is this? Seriously, I'm like, I don't know what he's talking about. And I'm like, okay, whatever. So, and then the whole thing about finally I have to ask him, like, what was all that? He goes, Carol, you're confusing the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I truly didn't know there was a difference. I told you I'm an idiot. So anyway, at this point too, Laura's pushing me to do the steps, and I'm not really that interested because, I just want to treat life like a big old Etch-a-Sketch. You shake it, start over. I'm sober, start over. And it's like, yeah, it's not really going to work. So the whole thing is like, how's that four-step coming, And I'm like, fine, I'll just write this thing out. So, the fourth and fifth step, magical. Now looking back, I'm like, I don't know what I was thinking that I didn't want to do it. Again, I'm an idiot. So I'll just give you one thing off my fifth step, my four-step list, so that you can kind of get a feeling of what was on the rest of it. And one of the names on my four-step was Lori Colson. And here was her crime. She, in seventh grade... I'm a grown woman, and I'm carrying around a resentment from seventh grade. Hello, I'm an idiot. So seventh grade, she told everybody on the bus that I was stuffing my bra. What was she thinking? Honestly, what? She ruined my life. It's her fault I'm not a doctor, in my mind. She ruined my junior high career. Subsequently, again, my life's a crap because of her. So you do the list and la la, and my sponsor's like, "What was your part in it?" I'm like, "Oh, I was stuffing my bra." So, okay, get it? Like everything on my list, I started the ball rolling. And it's bizarre because I had never thought to look at my part in it ever before, ever. You even look at the examples in the big book, I think they're hysterical now. Because it's like, I'm mad at my employer. He's unjust. He's unreasonable. Threatens to fire me for drinking on the job and padding my expense account. Yeah. Yeah. You think? So that's the deal, So that wasn't so bad. The fourth and fifth step wasn't so bad. All right. So what about, what about you start making amends? The bottom line is, I didn't really have an interest in doing the steps. But God had another plan. And here's the thing, too. The chapter to the agnostics saved my life. And because I was, every time I thought about God, I thought about Tammy Faye Baker and the makeup. and the money, and I swear. So I'm like thinking, great, this is what's going to save me. And in the book, it gives me an out. I can find something else that'll work for me. And let me tell you, I got a big old God now. And it's, for me, it's incredible to live without fear. It really is. It's amazing to me. So that's the bottom line. I do the steps. I trust God. I've cleaned house, and now I help others. And how am I doing? I can't just wait for you. All right. A little control issue here. Service. So I'm at a meeting, and they talk about there's a business meeting for the group I'm going to. And Laura, who's my little sponsor with the boniest elbows ever invented, pokes me about going to this business meeting. And they need a coffee maker. And... I'm telling you, I'm so embarrassed now. I thought the church made the coffee. I didn't know. Or the Keebler elves. I don't know. I don't care. I'm thinking, I put my buck in the basket. Let me alone. And she's, seriously, what do you want from me? So she's like, Carol, you've been a taker for a really long time, and it's about time that you learn to give. So she made me go to that business meeting. And I found out, man, there's a whole lot going on behind the curtain. You know what I mean? So that I have a place to sit. So my first job as a coffee maker, I suck at it. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm really bad at it. Because, first of all, I never even drank coffee till I got sober. My first cup was like that much powdered creamer, that much sugar, and then the rest coffee. It's like a brown syrup at this point, you know, but I wanted to fit in. So I don't understand coffee, and we've got these big giant urns, and remember, I'm an idiot, so I can't even count, you know what I mean? So it's like, I lost track. I'm like, I don't know. All right, one, two, I don't know. So it's either liquid crack or it's tea. You never know what you're getting. You don't. It could be anything. So, but they let me make it, and, you know, I got to tell you, most of the time, I grumbled. I just, you know, I was just like, ugh, got to go make coffee, you know? Got to, you know, any of it. And I got to tell you, this is the one story I remember this. There was a, you know, I'd moved up. I was supply person for a while, and then treasurer. They trusted me with the money. How cool was that? And that there was this one meeting I remember, big meeting Sunday. It was like church. Everybody would show up. They had a speaker meeting. It was just the best way to start our day, and everybody loved it. And I remember us announcing that, you know, we're going to have cleanup after the meeting. So if you could, you know, and you like this group, stick around and help us. And it's like a stampede, you know. At the end, everybody's just running out. There's just a couple of us, the same usual. And I remember I'm in the girls' bathroom, and I've got my rubber gloves on, and I've got this toilet brush. And I'm in on this toilet, like, I'm scrubbing this thing like we're going to serve soup out of it. I mean, I'm like, and I'm going nuts on this. And it dawned on me. You know that part where it talks about, you know, a spiritual experience, you know, a personality change sufficient enough to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And I realized that I was somebody different. Somebody different. I'm cleaning toilets for other people. Who does that? Not me. But there I was. And I realized that somehow along the line, without me even recognizing it, I mean, in a lot of ways this program reminds me of like your microwave. I don't know how it works. I don't know what's going on in there. I don't even know what's working until, like, the cheese explodes. You know what I mean? I don't know what's going on until, like, your lasagna is all over the inside. I don't know what's happening to me. You know what I mean? I don't know how it works. I just know that I'm not the same person that I used to be. You know what I mean? And that's totally a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I get to talk about my favorite part, which is what it's like now. I remember my four-step. You know, I was resentful at my parents because I didn't feel that they suitably encouraged me to go to college, you know, right? I was barely going to high school, and I'm mad that they don't, you know, want to encourage me to not go to college. So I remember putting out my list, and my sponsor was like, you know, you're a grown woman. You want to go to college, go to college. I'm like, I don't have any money. She's like, lots of people don't have any money. They go to college, fill out some paperwork, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me accountability for my own life and my own choices. And so I went back to college, and I got a degree, and I work for a drug company now. How's that? God has a sense of humor. You know, it's still the better living through chemistry, but really now, this time, really, we help people. You know, I'm a responsible citizen. I mean, I remember, I pay my car insurance early. I used to remember getting that stuff in the mail where it said your insurance will lapse at blah, 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 midnight. I figured I had till midnight to smack into something, and then I had to be careful. You know what I mean? Like, that's, I used to just throw stuff out in the mail. I never pay my bills. I mean, just, and now I'm like, I pay my taxes. You know, I my cars are insured like normal people. You know, I'm a productive member of society, you know, and that's shocking to me, but I guess if you just stick around, that's what happens. I try to do a 10-step and try and keep myself on track, because if I don't watch it very quickly, it goes off. For me, the difficulty hasn't so much been putting down the drink. It's been living within spiritual principles, you know, because I want to cheat. I want to lie about my taxes. You know, that's my natural instinct. You know what I mean? And I have to watch that stuff. And the other thing is I have to make sure that what AA has given me doesn't get in the way of AA, you know? And I've seen that happen to a lot of people. And I really don't want that to happen to me. So I go to a lot of meetings. I try to stay involved. I sponsor a girl. I love sponsoring this girl. If you've ever had a really willing sponsor, you know what I'm talking about. Half the time, I know what I'm telling her. You know, we sit down, I ask God to come in, and I'll give her some direction, and, you know, she'll go, okay. And I'm like, God, I hope this works. You know, like, I'm like, it just seems like the right thing to do. And she goes and does it. It's crazy. And then she'll call me back and say, hey, this is how it worked out. I'm like, awesome. I just love it. And, it, you know, working with others keeps me grounded. And I remember that I'm just as close to my next drink. You know, I'm just that close. You know, we just had a guy come and speak that had relapsed after 20 years, and I'm coming up on 20 years, and, you know, I got to remember. You know, that's, I got to keep doing what I've been doing, or I'm not going to keep getting what I'm getting. Are we at the minute yet? All right. 2 whole minutes. All right. What do we want to talk about? You know, I have a great relationship with my parents. I adore them. Alcoholics Anonymous has repaired literally every relationship I've ever damaged. You know, that's a result of making amends, making living amends, and continuing to try to do the right thing. They talk about, the big book, about not having an ability to form a meaningful relationship with somebody. I'm sure I'm paraphrasing that very badly, but I love people now. You know, being sober isn't about, you know, money, property, or prestige. It's about sitting, like, at a diner and just sitting and having a meal with people in AA and feeling connected, at least in a way that I never felt connected before. You know, that was a part of my disease, too. And when I drank, my world got very, very small. You know, and now it's really ginormous, you know. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but I know when I wake up, I'm really kind of excited about what the possibilities of the day are. Do you know what I mean? It's really exciting to me. Oh, good, a minute. I was promised a lollipop at the end of this. I just want to make sure that's still on the table. I get inspiration from a lot of different things, and it was funny. I just heard Dr. Phil. I like him. I don't know. He said, you know what? He was speaking to a group of people, and he said, you know what? In a year from now, 1 year from today, your life is either going to be better or it's going to be worse. It's that simple. And it really, when you think about it, hey, Dr. Phil, that's pretty bright, you know? You think about it, like, you're right. In a whole year from now, it's either going to be here or it's going to be there. He says, where it's going to be is the result of the choices that you make. If you're new or struggling in sobriety, I hope you stick around. Keep coming back. And I will leave you with this, a statement from the Big Book that had so much impact on my life when I first got sober. And that is, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Thank you so much.